Hello, everybody. My name is Charlie Haviland. I'm a recovered alcoholic. For those of you who'd care to, please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you. Miracles happen, don't they? Can I get an amen, maybe? Amen. Miracles happen. I have a short story about my experience with prayer. Can you hear me? Okay. I have a short story about my experience with prayer. Is that better? Okay. About 5 years ago, I was the GSR, the General Service Representative of my home group, and this meeting met 7 days, and so it wasn't as if we saw each other once a week and that was it. This was a group that came to know each other, and at one of our group consciences, we were getting ready to close, and there was a man in our group who, from my perception, caused great harm. You know, he was the classic 13th stepper, and we saw many women come in for just a little bit and never see them again. And I thought this was wrong. It was a judgment. And before we closed the meeting, I asked our secretary, Mary Beth, if we could talk about a personality. And she said, sure, but let's close first. And we stood up and said the Lord's Prayer. And when we were done, Mary Beth looked at me and said, now what do you want to talk about? And I said, it went away. And she said, I thought it would. And what I couldn't know at that time, it was a forerunner of what I'd learned 2 or 3 years down the road, which is 2 or 3 years ago, that this was the forerunner of my experience with the 10th step, that when I listened to Mark Houston not too long ago, and he broke the 10th step down. You know, I used to live in on page 86, you know, when we retire at night and upon awakening. And, you know, my life really didn't get better. You know, I was married to my job, and about the time I left my corporate job in 2009, I heard Mark Houston talk about the concrete steps in step 10. We continue to watch. We ask God at once. We turn our thoughts to another alcoholic. That's what was happening to me when we said that prayer. And but I didn't know it was going to get better. And it's my experience that you know, prayer is overrated in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are some of us who come in and we're told that if we pray, everything will be all right. You know, faith without works, prayers without works is dead. And for me, if I rely on prayer after I put the plug in the jug, I'm just getting the same thing I did before when I was doing foxhole prayers in the county jail. And I'm just praying for results, I'm not praying for strength. And about 5 years ago was the beginning of my of the journey that has brought me here today. My sobriety date is May 19th, 2005. it's really a joy to be here. I got a classic alcoholic form. I got off the plane, and within an hour, I'm thinking, why can't I live here? You know, it's all about me. But San Diego is so awesome. I live in Detroit, you know, and I ain't going back. But I want to thank the committee. I want to thank Linda for inviting me. I want to thank Jen for setting up my schedule. I want to thank Eric for being a great host. I'm going to talk a little bit about Eric. We had a wonderful morning. And Roxy picked me up at the airport. And when Linda texted me this, because I was in airports for 15 hours coming from Detroit. It was not the funnest trip, but I knew where I was going, so that kept me going. And Linda texted me that Roxy is picking me up, and I'm thinking the last time a woman named Roxy picked me up, it was probably one of my other war stories. I mean, and we got to the hotel, and my room wasn't ready, and we went for some coffee, and there were cops everywhere. And Roxy told me, Jerry, the governor's here, Jerry Brown is here. And I'd worked for Jerry Brown in Colorado in 1992 when he was running for president. Awesome. Linda Ronstadt's in the audience. And, You know, and I had lunch with Jerry Brown, and he spoke extemporaneously for 90 minutes. It amazed me, and I was passionate about him, and I was sober. You know, this is not my only sobriety date. This is my current sobriety date, May 19, 2005. But in 1992, I was 4 years sober, and I love the man. I've been a political activist all my life. So while we're having coffee, I said, let's go hunt down the governor, and maybe I can shake Jerry Brown's hand. And so we did. And we walked into toward this building and walked into a wall of cops. It was the California Sheriff's Association that was having a conference here, and Jerry Brown was pitching his budget, which included tax increases, and part of what he was pitching was a program that would reduce recidivism. And, you know, I don't think this much anymore about getting my way, bowling over people and getting my way through, but Roxy said, we walked up to the police, and Roxy said, the cop said, can I help you? And Roxy said, yeah, we're with the next convention, and Charlie's our keynote speaker. And the cop looked at me, and he said, what are you going to talk about? And I stuck out my hand and said, my name is Charlie Haviland, I'm an ex-felon, and we're going to talk about alcoholism this weekend. And he said, come right on in. So that was, I didn't see the governor, but, you know, it's, you know, I'm still on a high being in San Diego and being around so many recovered alcoholics who you can take one look in their eyes and see that they're on the same path that I've been so blessed to be on. If you were at the comedy show last night, you were there? Now, do you remember, at the very end, is it Mark Pace, James? Mike Pace, with the headliner. And when he brought the newcomer up on stage, how can I not feel the most powerful moment that happens to me in Alcoholics Anonymous? Bill writes about that on the first page, you know, the only chapter devoted to a whole step, working with others. And he writes it on the first page of that chapter. He says it twice. He says, the joy of seeing other people recover, this is an experience you must not miss, period. Then he says, you will not want to miss this. And I didn't last night. And that was so awesome. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I want to welcome our friends from Al-Anon, any newcomers. I'm really glad to see you here. It's my experience that, you know, alcoholism is a disease. Alcoholism is a family disease. I didn't buy the disease concept for a while. It was, you know, some of us have more resistance and defensiveness than others when we get here. It wasn't until I got a solid first step that I accepted alcoholism as a disease. You know, it's chronic, progressive, and fatal. It meets that criteria, and that's my experience. To say alcoholism is a family disease is even a little more abstract. You know, and Lois Wilson said alcoholism, or self-righteousness, unlike alcoholism, doesn't need to be covered up. And I was facilitating a midnight roundtable at a conference like this some time ago at midnight, and I represent Stepping Stones, the home of Bill and Lois Wilson, and I had done a program that day, and I was exhausted, and there was a room something like this, and there were about 400 people in the room, and I'm looking right down the middle, and the topic was, how can we carry on Lois's legacy? And what Lois wanted to do is carry the message of alcoholics outside of the traditions, and which is just teach the world about alcoholism. And everybody else was so tired. And I said, what do you want? I had a chair and a microphone, and I said, what do you want to talk about? And there was no response. So what God does for me, what I can't do for myself, and these words came out of my mouth, and I said, do family and friends of alcoholics have physical pain? And I couldn't have known this. I'm looking straight down the middle. All the Al-Anons were on my right, and all the drunks were on my left. And that's about right. Jessica Cooper, who had been our Al-Anon speaker from the L.A. area, she spoke up, and this conversation lasted for 3.5 hours. You know, we went to almost daylight. And I simply asked the question, do Al-Anons have physical pain? And Jessica Cooper raised her hand and said, we die from alcoholism. We die from cancer. caused by stress. We die of heart attacks. We die in car accidents. We die fatally from at the hand of our lovers who are alcoholics. And I think, I'm not sure, but I think that was the day I stopped making Al-Anon jokes. Because alcoholics are famous for making Al-Anon jokes. So I want to extend my hand to those of you who are friends and family of alcoholics, and I'm glad you're here. And if you're new, I'm also glad to see you, like I saw the woman last night standing on the stage. And if you're new, please keep coming back and don't give up. The last 2 years of my life have been the best 2 years of my life, but 2.5 years. And I'm a middle-aged man from Detroit. So, and I've lived in some exotic places and have had some great jobs, but when I got sober on May 19th, it was the Royal Oak Police in Michigan took the bottle of vodka out of my hands and took me out of the car and put me in the jail cell where I stayed. I eventually went to prison for 21 months. And when I got out of prison, I had a plan of meetings. I went to about 400 meetings in the next 12 months. And a woman who became my sponsor, a de facto sponsor, roped me into a conference like this. She said, "Charlie, you want to be the hospitality co-chair?" And I'm saying yes, not knowing what's going to happen. I'm not a conference guy, but here I am 6 and 7 years later with my heart and life in this part of the service work. There's really nothing that can replace taking another man or woman through the book, but this is where I've learned my life lessons in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I was a hospitality co-chair, then I was the hospitality chair, and I thought that was enough. And at the wrap-up meeting, I was nominated to be the conference co-chair, and I demurred. And then someone nominated me to be the program co-chair, and I thought, God's got something else in mind for me, and I said yes. And here I am 4 years later, still working with the Tri-County Conference in Detroit. By the way, you know, this is not an easy thing to put on. There are meetings, and there are meetings, and there are meetings, and there are disagreements. And how about giving the committee a hand for putting this together? I heard four things in the last 2.5 years that have made all the promises come true, the ninth step promises, and more importantly, the 10-step promises. I was at a meeting last year, a midnight meeting. I'm really retired. I'm a part-time bartender, and once in a while, you know, I'm done with work at 11:30, and I'll hit a midnight meeting, and I was far away from my home at a meeting that I never go to, and I was asked to read the promises. And when I got to the last promise, I heard this for the first time in my life. We suddenly realized that God's doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. I'm such a self-centered alcoholic that I thought God started doing for me when I noticed. But we suddenly realized that God's been, you know, the footprints in the sand business. And four things that I heard. I was introduced to a man named Chip, who some of you may be familiar with the Big Book Step Study movement in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he's a big book thumper. And within 40 seconds of meeting Chip, he says to me, "Do you wake up selfish in the morning?" I was dumbfounded. I didn't know the answer to that question. You know, as I said, I've spent my days and months and years on page 86, "When We Retire at Night and Upon Awakening." So I thought about that. And within weeks, I realized, you know, that, and you hear Bob Olson talk, you'll hear him tomorrow night. He was once my grand sponsor. I'm very blessed to have come from a great line of sobriety in Denver. That when I go to sleep at night, grateful, in the 11th step, when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. And I go to sleep, my ego undergoes this great reconstruction project. And so when I wake up, I'm as selfish as I was the day I came in here. And so before I open my eyes, I say part of the third step prayer. And it hasn't failed since I realized when Chip said, "Do you wake up selfish in the morning?" Before I even opened my eyes, I said, "God, relieve me of the bondage of self. And then I can get on with my day." And So that was one. The second thing I heard, Jan V, she asked me, we were talking, I don't like, I'm trying to work the word sponsor and sponsee out of my vocabulary. I talk about people I work with, and we're talking about one of the people I was working with, and Jan V said to me, do you suppose she's ready for Joe Hawk? And I hadn't heard that name in probably 15 years, and I probably hadn't thought about Joe Hawk in 15 years. I had gotten sober in Denver shortly after he did. He had moved to Santa Barbara, but I saw him often at York Street, and what an impact he made on me. So I felt like this gift had been re-bestowed. And I started listening to Joe Hawk, and his message was quite powerful, especially in the first step where we talk about the essential question, what is wrong with me? Because the answers are concrete again, like Mark Houston talking about continue to watch, ask God at once, turn your thoughts, you know, watch, ask, turn. That's where my life has been in the last 2.5 years. When I feel uncomfortable, I immediately stop and ask God for help. You know, in the 12 and 12, Bill wrote that when we are disturbed, there's something wrong with us, no matter what's going on. If I'm uncomfortable, there's something wrong with us. So I started listening to Joe Hawk again, and I'm starting to feel, I was sharing with Virginia behind the, where she's selling literature, that she said, you look confused, and I was. And today I am confused, but I'm at peace. 3 years ago I was clear, but I was still a little cocky. And as I started this journey in the last 2 years, I became more and more confused, but I felt more and more peaceful. And today I live my life unafraid, but vulnerable, and it's a great place to be. Confusion is not a negative feeling. It's not an uncomfortable feeling. It's an okay place to be, just like sadness. And so I get to go there. And today my home group, I just changed home groups. I've had 4 home groups in the last 5 years. My home group is called Carry This Message, in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, and it's out of the book. There was a time 2 years ago where I was upset about my current home group. Now, the home group I got when I got out of prison, I left because I got a job in a restaurant, and it wasn't consistent with going to meetings at 7 o'clock in the morning, 7 days a week. And I changed up home groups, and I found this group where there was this, in Detroit we break up into groups, and then we call them tables. And I haven't seen this anywhere else in the United States. And I heard this great message from these old timers. They were 10 and 15 and 20 and 25 years sober. And they talked about their experience. And it seemed like they were living in the promises. Then 2 years later, 30 months later, I'm hearing the same stories they've been telling for the last 10 years of their life. You know, Johnny Harris talks, you know, I drop a lot of names. It's part of the self-seeking character defect that I have. But these are the people that have carried the message to me. And when Johnny came to Detroit, you know, we hear these things, and maybe we digest them, maybe we don't. Maybe they go right through in one ear and out the other. But Johnny said, you know, I'm not sober today because of what I did 10 years ago or what I did last month or what I did yesterday. What am I going to do today to stay sober? And in this home group where, and now I'm starting to be affected, and I'm becoming confused. And I thought, here I am hanging out with people who carry the message. And these are the kind of people I want to be around. And we had a rogue first step table that went against group conscience. A man 7 years running, you know, we lead tables, we chair meetings, but he was running this table, and that was his, and he owned it. And he told people that it was okay not to do the steps. You just keep coming back. And I started calling the killing table. And there were those that didn't understand that when we don't carry the message, we may not be, we may be contributing to someone else's demise. The third thing I heard was a man named Alan Mindell. He did it in a talk, something like this, and he said, the worst advice we can give an Alcoholics Anonymous, first of all, we're really not supposed to give advice. This is what Bill set the example. The worst advice we can give an Alcoholics Anonymous is to tell someone to go get a sponsor. If I see a man or a woman that needs help, I better make sure that I will show that person, offer my help to take them through the book, or set them up with someone who will. And that was the most important thing I've heard in the last 3 years, because it has affected every decision I make. You know, in the end of the 10th step, Bill instructs us that, and it's a promise and an instruction, that there's a proper use of the will, and that is to carry the message and to practice these principles. So with every breath I take, this is what I try to do. And it's become more confusing. And in the last 3 years, I was talking to some old timers who live in the promises, and I was telling them about this weird thing that was happening to me. It used to be that I was clear, and I carried a strong, confident message, but I was a little cocky. And today I feel confused, but I feel peaceful, which is okay. But I wanted so much not to feel alone. In my very first committee meeting with the Tri-County Conference's hospitality co-chair, this year we're in our 25th year, so this would be maybe the 19th or 20th annual Tri-County Conference. The conference married into an intergroup, and they became joined at the hip. And for 20 years, this is what they did. There was no rotation of leadership. There was seven panels for years, the same seven panels, and attendance kept going down. And the permanent secretary, the permanent treasurer, was also the manager of the intergroup. And I saw him throw a chair. He was so mad, and he picked up a chair, and he threw it across the room. And I'm sitting in a room with 50 people thinking, there's something wrong with this. But no one else responded in kind. So I thought, there's something wrong with me. What is wrong with me? Because all these other people can't be wrong. And so began my journey of confusion. But today I stand here before you, and the fourth thing I heard was Bob Olson say last year, I live unafraid but remain vulnerable. And a light went on. I get that. A woman, I believe, her name is Judy from Tucson. She may be in the room tonight. But the last thing she said to me was, it's been a pink cloud ever since, that aha moment. Thank God. When we tell people to get off the pink cloud, you know, the way I feel today is valid, and I should own it. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been told that I'm full of crap, and I tend to believe that. And I don't have to believe that anymore. So my life is awesome today. And I didn't, when I first heard those words, I live unafraid but vulnerable, I didn't understand it. And this is an example of how that works for me. I was called to bartend a gig in downtown Detroit when the Lions were in town. And the Detroit Lions had a great year. So they were filling up the stadium. As a matter of fact, I was there and watched Philip Rivers, and I've pulled for the Chargers, but that just wasn't going to happen. It would have been, you know, I lived in Denver for 20 years, and I was talking to Eric about that today. Eric says he's a Charger fan. I said, you are a sports fan. He says, no, I'm a Chargers fan. our cheerleading chant is next year, but in the Denver years, I saw John Elway's every game. Not every game. I saw his first game and his second to last game, and with Eric Coryell and Dan Fouts. And the Chargers had a formidable team. But I got called to do this bartending gig, so there was nowhere to park. The Detroit Opera House has a structure that's seven stories. I had to park on the top. And I got on the elevator, and I hit the button. And if any of you have ever been in the Marriott Marquis in New York, where the elevators are glass, you may know what this feels like. So I hit the first floor, and this glass elevator overlooking downtown Detroit just dropped. And I was scared to death. I was scared to death for a moment, just like I was before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was instructed to continue to watch for fear. Ask God at once to remove this fear. Then turn my thoughts to another alcoholic. Did I do that? No, I cowered and I turned away, and I knew this would end. So I live most of my waking moments unafraid, but that vulnerability is right there, and I can get hit just like that. I grew up in New York, And my father, I'm the oldest of nine kids. I grew up in a New York suburb in Westchester County. And my dad used to take me for a ride while he'd drink beer. And my job was to look out while he tossed the empty cans over the top of the car. And, you know, the funny thing was, I was looking out for only cops. You know, he didn't care if there were others, vigilantes looking out. And this was a ritual. My reward were airplane bottles of Southern Comfort. And I liked it because it's sweet. I don't remember the effect. And that happened for a little while when I was 4, 5, and 6. But when I took my first drink at 13, I drank alcoholically. I blacked out. I crossed that line. And thank God for booze, because whiskey was that solution. And for the next 18 years, I had two principles in my life that I practiced in every affair, and that was to protect my supply and ensure that my next drink would be there. And I later learned when I did my first inventory that I was scared to death, since I could remember at 3, of everything all the time. You know, I wasn't a happy child. I was attention-seeking. All I wanted was comfort, and I wanted the discomfort to go away, which it never did, until I took that first drink. And I kept a bottle of whiskey in my locker in high school, and there was a promise that I could have been, in my class, perhaps the best baseball player in New York State. And in my senior year, we had practice inside, and I played all the positions, and I was drunk at practice, and I was playing catcher without a mask, and I got beaned, and that was the end of my baseball career. So I went to college, and here are my icons. My icons were Mickey Mantle, Jack Kerouac, Hunter Thompson, and John Cheever. Now, John Cheever, the great American author, his daughter, Susan Cheever, John Cheever died sober. Mickey Mantle died sober. Hunter Thompson killed himself. And Jack Kerouac eviscerated himself with alcohol. And John Cheever's daughter, Susan, she wrote a biography of Bill. My name is Bill W. and is a friend of Stepping Stones. Just a month ago, I was in New York, and I was in Ossining, and I shared in a meeting there the same thing I just shared with you. And there was an old-timer, 3 or 4, who shared after me, and he looked at me and he said, "Charlie, you're sitting in Cheever's chair." And I felt less alone, like I've felt in the last 3 years of my life. And I went on to college in Buffalo, and Hunter Thompson was coming to speak, and I went to pick him up. And he was late, and he was a miserable son of a bitch, but he was still my hero. We got to the, you know, if you've ever been to a college auditorium where comics or speakers speak, the place was packed, and the people were pissed. And we got to the university, and there was a 8-foot banquet table and a chair and a microphone. And Hunter Thompson brought his briefcase out. He opened it up, and he pulled out a bottle of Chivas. And he cleared his throat and looked to his left and said, "Anybody got any ice?" And we waited for him to get his ice and take his drink. And he cleared his throat and said, "What do you want to talk about?" And this was a time when he was friendly with Muhammad Ali, and the conversation lasted, and it was good. But I'm thinking, that's what I want to be. I want to be exactly that. And I did, not to that extent. You know, I moved to Colorado and got a job as a journalist, and I would see my copy in print the next day after I filed, having no idea of even covering, never mind writing. To this day, I don't know, and I'm friends with editors from that time on Facebook. I have no idea if they helped me out or if I filed copy that was all right. But by the time I got sober, my first sobriety date was March 6th, 1988. And I went to 400 meetings. I got sober at York Street in Denver. This was a lot of the guys from the Denver Young People's Group, the Joe Hawk and Bob Olson and Big Frank were there. And I did the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the promises were coming true. And I had 3 drinking driving charges under my belt by the time I got sober. And I was leaving. I got a job as a bartender in downtown in one of the nice houses, and it was a good job. And I was driving home one night without my lights on. I didn't have a license, and I got pulled over. And I got an array of tickets, of which I don't remember the totality, but I got a ticket for driving without a license, driving under denial, and driving while suspended, driving without insurance, and on and on, driving without headlights. And when I went to court, 7 men from York Street were walking me in. My sponsor, Steve Mead, said, "Charlie, it looks like you're in luck. Big Frank, I mean God, is walking into the building." And I was feeling good about my sobriety. You know, I had done the pre-probation report, and my lawyer was from the fellowship. And we're before this judge. And the judge instructed said, "Counselor, have you told your client that he's looking at a mandatory 5 years in Canyon City in the state pen because of the array of misdemeanors add up to a felony?" And she didn't know this. And my heart sunk, but I was okay. And I had recalled Christopher Mullen, who was a great basketball player from St. John's and later the Golden State Warriors, had just recovered or was in the process of recovering. And I read a story about how Chris was confronted by his coach, Don Nelson, and what Chris talked about, what went through his mind. And he said, "You know, this jig is up. The con is over." So the judge looks at me and says, "Mr. Haviland, it looks like there's one out for you. If there was an emergency, then I don't have to send you to prison." And my lawyer looks at me and she said, "Mr. Haviland, there was an emergency, wasn't there?" Now, what came next was surprising. The judge looked at my lawyer and said, "Shut up, counselor." And the payoff came next. The judge said, "Mr. Haviland looks like a man who's enjoying his sobriety." And I'm only 8 or 9 months, but I had been well on my way in finishing my amends. So the judge looked at me and said, "Mr. Haviland, was there an emergency?" And I thought of Chris Mullen. This was a no-brainer. God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I said, "No, Your Honor, there wasn't an emergency." And I could see him writing down emergency existed, and he cut me loose with an $85 fine. And this was, I couldn't have planned that for myself. I went to more than 400 meetings my first year sober in 1988. And I continued to do the work, and my career was getting better. And by the I had a radio program in Denver, and I was on the air New Year's Eve, 94, 95, and I was drunk. But what happened in between is noteworthy. When I hear someone say that, you know, and if you've gone to a lot of meetings, you've heard this. When someone relapses, what is the first thing they say? "I stopped going to meetings." Well, for me, that's a lot of nonsense. My relapse stopped. My relapse started when I stopped working with others. And I still went to meetings. But slowly but surely, I was becoming affected by alcoholism and my thinking. And so, you know, meetings don't treat alcoholism. I'm working with a guy. I'm sponsoring this guy. 5 years, he cannot put 30 days together. And finally, he got fired, arrested, and spent 90 days in jail. And I've seen this man go to thousands of meetings, and he can't stay sober. So from the time I stopped working with alcoholics in the early 90s, my relapse was well on its way, and I picked up a drink in 94, 95, and I had been diagnosed with depression. And I was treated for it with medication. And what followed was today I have 11 mental health diagnoses. You know, and Dr. Silkworth talks about this, you know, the unwritten chapter. I went to, in Denver, we had the unwritten chapter meeting. And everybody who came, it seemed, had untreated bipolar disorder. And the meetings would last 3 hours. And people would stay. And between 1995 and May 19th, 2005, I was sober probably 8 years out of 10, but not in a row. I got 1 3-year chip. I got 2 2-year chips. I got 3 1-year chips and a boatload of 30-day chips. But I was that man who was scared to death all the time, just like I was between ages of 3 and 13. I had untreated alcoholism. And when I got arrested on May 19th, 2005, by the time I was in booking, the third step happened to me. I knew I was safe. And this would carry on into prison. One of the jobs I got in prison was someone got wind that I knew a little bit about baseball, and so I became the scorekeeper, and then the lead umpire. And I'm a newbie, and there are guys in there. Michigan doesn't have the death penalty, so there are guys in there who have done heinous, heinous things. And as an umpire, on occasion, it's your job to throw somebody out of the game. And tempers flared. Not often, but sometimes, and the guards just stood on the side and let it all play out. But I was living really unafraid at that time, too. I felt protected. I ended up hearing more than 5, 6 fifth steps in prison from men that would never get out. And this is when the light went on for me, that fourth column. Wow, what is my part in it? I've learned more from taking other men and women through the work than doing a fifth step of my own with my sponsor. So by the time I got out of prison, you know, I'm helping out, putting on gigs like these, and when I had become program chairman, there was some politics going on. There was a committee to change the bylaws. We changed the bylaws from our primary purpose is to raise money to our primary purpose is to carry this message. And it pissed a lot of people off. It pissed the intergroup off, and they took it personally. And I wasn't part of that movement, but I was on the steering committee, and I watched this happen. And when Alan Mindell said, the worst advice we can give anybody is tell them to go get a sponsor, this is what I heard. Because I saw what was happening was important. We must do this. I don't have a choice anymore. You know, it's the part of that 10th step that Bill wrote about. This is the only proper use of the will. What? To carry out God's will in all of our activities. You know, when I hear this in meetings often, I'm taking my will back, and it breaks my heart. You know, my sponsor, Gary Stroop, he showed me that I only have to do the third step once. I make that commitment. I take lessons from the third step. You know, when I promise to do something, I try to follow through. That's the lesson in the third step. But when I become selfish, as identified in the fourth column, that's all that happens. You know, it's not like I'm doing the third step all day long. It drives me nuts. And so I'm slowly getting sucked into this business of seeing that things are done right. And we went from 7 panels to 27 panels, and I'm the program chair. I'm way over my head. And we had a brainstorming session where we came up with 27 panels, and among them was depression and AA, sober and depressed, really. We put the word sobriety before everything because it comes first. And we also had a panel called gay in AA. It was overwhelmingly disapproved by the committee. Now, I thought something was wrong, and I did what you folks taught me what to do, and I went out and I asked for help. I went to gay meetings. My best friend from high school lives in L.A., and I talked to him. I talked to my sponsor, and nobody seemed to have an answer or a suggestion. It was like this, you know, leave me out of it, Charlie. And so I had 30 days to think about this and ask God for help. And, you know, Eric and I were talking about, Eric's got this great job, do you mind? Where he's a project manager with capital projects and millions of dollars. And it's his job to bring the bad news if there is any. And I asked him, do you feel alone when this takes place? Because you're not going to get advice from different vested interests. And he said this. This is remarkable because this is how I found my way. When I present a problem, I always come with a solution. It may not be the right solution, but I have a solution. So I had 30 days to think about what to do, and nobody seemed to be wanting to be helpful. So I went, what would Bill Wilson do? And I went to the first 164 pages, I went to the 12 and 12, and I went to the service manual. And the service manual is an essay that Bill wrote in 1959 about leadership and how to deal with our critics. And Bill said, we have destructive critics, we have constructive critics. We have to give them all a careful hearing. There are sometimes when the destructive critic may be right on, and there are sometimes when the constructive critic will be way off, but we must give them a careful hearing. And if our critics are partially true, or half true, or entirely true, we must thank them, make our amends, and get on with our respective inventories. If our critics are totally wrong, we must try to persuade them and then pray for them if they're still too sick to see the light. So I got some comfort in this. Thank goodness for the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. With Bill Wilson's words, I worked something out that I was going to read to the committee and hopefully persuade them. And I want to share that with you tonight because I felt so alone for 30 days. I was scared to death. I didn't know what the outcome would be, and it really didn't matter. It was just during those 30 days, I didn't know if I was right or if I was wrong. And I wanted to be right. And I was pissed off, too. And this is what I constructed. If you'll indulge me, this is going to take me 3 minutes to read, but I read this at the next committee meeting. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we hear, when anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I'm responsible. When the committee voted to exclude the panel for gay alcoholics, I became disturbed. It is my responsibility as your conference program chairman to follow principles and traditions. Why would a collective body exclude a panel for gays and lesbians? Intolerance was my only guess. I don't pretend to know what's in another's heart. Sometimes I don't know what's in my own. But I couldn't imagine any other reason for this exclusion. I cannot in good conscience let this be. Good conscience, let this be. Silence is a danger to my recovery, according to Bill Wilson. He wrote in the fifth tradition, quote, if we neglect those who are still sick, there is unremitting danger to our own lives and sanity. Our fifth tradition states each group has but one primary purpose, to carry a message to the alcoholic who still suffers. This is our singleness of purpose. Bill Wilson specifically instructed us to welcome gays and lesbians. And I took this out of the 12 and 12. He wrote, Alcoholics Anonymous would always leave the door open, he wrote, to beggars, tramps, asylum inmates, prisoners, queers, plain crackpots, and fallen women. We must not turn our backs on anyone. This includes unemployed, now I'm in Detroit, this includes unemployed auto workers, convicted felons, and deadbeat dads. The third tradition states the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Bill expounded upon this. Intolerant, you say. Well, we were frightened. Naturally, we begin to act like most everybody does when afraid. After all, isn't fear the true basis of intolerance? Yes, we were intolerant. Bill goes on, at last, experience taught us to take away any alcoholic's full chance with some time to pronounce his death sentence. And I'm calling this rogue first step table the killing tables. And those who don't understand, I wouldn't have understood it 5 years myself. Bill wrote, "Who dared to be judge, jury, and executioner of his own sick brother or sister?" Why am I making this case, you may ask? Because this is what you've taught me to do. I am responsible. Bill wrote in the first tradition, "Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity." Bill also insisted that our lives actually depend on obedience to spiritual principles. "If we deviate too far," he said, "the penalty is sure and swift. We will sicken and die." "I do not want to sicken and die," Bill wrote in the 12th step. "We no longer strive to dominate or rule about us in order to gain self-importance. So I humbly ask the conference committee to join me in support of placing Gay and AA on the 23rd annual Tri-County Conference program as we trudge this road together and lovingly placing principles before personalities." And before we took our vote, we had a discussion, and this woman raised her hand and said, "But Charlie, don't they have their own conferences?" Now, what happened next, what I'm thinking, didn't come out of my mouth. I don't know how it didn't come out of my mouth, but I wanted to say, "Women have their own conferences, but you're welcome here, aren't you?" And we took a vote, and there was one abstention, and it was the woman who wondered about gay AA conferences. And when I was in Los Angeles last year working, I'm producing a play called Bill and Lois in Their Own Words. It's completely constructed of their love letters over 61 years, their talks and their essays. And Clancy read Bill W.'s part. And during a rehearsal, Clancy, he looks at me and says, "Chuck, get over here." He says, "You ever see a 52-year chip?" I guess I haven't, Clancy, dude. And I wasn't wearing a tie. Clancy says, "When Chuck Chamberlain, my sponsor," and I said, time out. "Dude, Chuck C was your sponsor?" "Yeah." And he said, "Some rapist had just gotten out of prison and he's spending all his time with him." And I said, "Chuck, why are you talking to that guy?" And my sponsor told me, "Because I'm going to die soon and you're going to have to talk to him." And that was the message that I had to... My goodness, you know, for 30 days I didn't know where I was and what to do, but for the grace of God and folks like you. You know, it's a joy to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor says that whenever he shares, you know. And June of 2010, I had the opportunity to spend some time with George McGovern. Now, Hunter Thompson spent the campaign of 1972 with McGovern and Nixon and chronicled it in a book called Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, 1972. And I had just found a first edition of this volume in Florida a year earlier. And I used to be a book collector. I became a book dealer. And, I still have a library that's for sale except for this book. And... In 1994, before I relapsed, Terry McGovern, his daughter, froze to death on the streets of Madison, Wisconsin. She was an alcoholic. And George McGovern was 88 years old when I saw him. He was pitching a book that he had written about Abraham Lincoln. But he said he wrote the memoir of his daughter, Terry, and that he'd written 19 books, and this was his only bestseller. So I had my Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail that I wanted George to sign. And when I approached him, now God's doing for me what I won't do for myself. You know, the converse of that is God won't do for me what I can do for myself. You know, God will sow the seeds, but we got to get out of the nest and go get them. So I remember when Terry McGovern died, I was still sober in 94, and my heart broke. You know, one of the gifts is we get to have empathy. And my brother in 1992, my youngest brother, I'm the oldest of nine, had committed suicide. He was working in the He was working in the State Department during the first Bush administration, and he was suffering from depression. And when I had gotten the phone call the Sunday morning, my then girlfriend was in the room when my mother had called me, you know, and my brother Ed was five times as smart as I am, and he was the favorite. I learned that Ed had died by his own hand, and my then girlfriend said, first thing she said, and she's not even in the program, she said, did you make amends with him? And I had. And the tragedy of that was, you know, and I'm a selfish alcoholic, sometimes I forget, I watched my mother lose a son, and that was worse than the loss of my own. But for the grace of God, I learned that, and I went through, by the time I relapsed on New Year's Eve in 1995, I went straight into treatment. I had wonderful people around me, and we did grief work around the loss of my brother. So when I approached the senator, I said this to him. If I had thought about it, I never would have said it. I said, I remember when you lost Terry. And when I lost my brother Ed by his own hand, I learned that he did not die in vain, and he walks beside me. And I'm so sorry for the loss of Terry, who had to die so others like myself would live. And he stood up, and he's a couple inches taller than me, and he put his arm around me. And what came next was pretty amazing. He said, Charlie, I'm really proud. He called me by name. Charlie, I'm really proud of you. Now, it used to be when someone would pay me a compliment, I would defer all the glory to God out loud. And that's changed too. And I've learned that when someone pays me a compliment or says something nice, I simply say thank you and I thank God silently. And so I looked at the senator and I said, thank you. And it used to be I had this false modesty. I could never use those words, I'm really proud of you. You know, I work with others, and when they, you know, part of my journey today is, you know, I'm starting to understand the difference between unwillingness and powerlessness. Today I am not powerless over alcohol. My life is manageable. That's promised to me in the 11th step. So I looked at the senator and I said, thank you. Thank you. And I look at all of you. You know, it's easy for me to come here, come to any meeting. I've been to thousands of meetings. It's really easy for me to come up to a podium and speak into a microphone. There are others who've come after me, and some who've been coming for a long time who are still scared to death. And they still show up. You know, there's a woman in my home group. She's 20 years sober, and she's helped me. But when she goes out of town, she still calls ahead to have the wet bar emptied. My goodness, I don't want to live like that. And whenever I get behind a podium in front of a microphone and I look out, I wish all of you could be up here to see what it looks like, to see all this courage, this humanity of recovery. And I want to thank you. Bob Olson, he may say this tomorrow night, but he says it. He says, you know, why do I do the work? Because I may need it tomorrow. And I may need your courage tomorrow. I made the inspiration for your willingness. So I just want to tell you, I'm proud of all of you, and I'm glad you're here. Thank you very much.